This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Annabelle Gurwitch has worked in a lot of different places doing a variety of jobs. Many of those jobs have caught your attention or may have caught your attention, beginning with her stint as the original hostess of Dinner and a Movie on TBS.
Glad you tuned into Dinner and a Movie tonight, because we're watching the creepy hand that rocks the cradle.
That's right. This movie stars the sexy, the devilish Rebecca De Mornay. It also stars Annabelle Sciorra. And
Julianne Moore has a nice part in it.
She's lovely, even though she doesn't get naked.
No, she doesn't, but you know it does get naked?
What?
Our rockabye baby back ribs.
But then we're going to cover them up with some delicious barbecue sauce.
Oh, yeah.
So watch a little of the movie when we come back. We'll show you what you need to make your...
And Gurwitch also hosted HBO's Not Necessarily the News. She has worked as an NPR commentator, and she's been fired, not by NPR, but by Woody Allen. Not to worry, she's turned that experience into a New York Times best-selling book. In fact, she had more than a few New York Times best-selling books. Her latest is I See You Made an Effort, Compliments, Indignities, and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50. It's a collection of essays about the indignities of turning a certain age, as the book jacket calls it, a coming-of-middle-age story, which Bill Maher says should be required reading for anyone between the ages of 40 and death. He stole that line from Maine, by the way. Annabelle Gurwitch is on her way to town to speak at the Jewish Federation Spring Lecture next week. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org, and she joins us for the hour from Los Angeles, early in the morning in L.A. Can you be funny this early in the morning?
I don't think so. It's hard to be funny later in the morning. So really early in the morning, we will find out, won't we?
Yes, we will. I have to tell you, I have no sympathy for your turning 50 because I'm older than you. I vaguely remember the pain of turning 50, but it's only a vague memory because I can no longer remember anything.
Listen, you know, the funny thing is when I started thinking about writing this book, I was 49, and I thought, oh, this will be great. I'll finish it when I'm 50. We'll have this big party. Well, because my brain works, let's just say, differently now, it took me 2 years to write it, so I'm 53 now. So I wrote a book about turning 50. It comes out when I'm 53. Well,
what can you do? You know, turning 50 doesn't really creep up on you, because as you point out, and I thought this was just me, I thought somehow they got my information. I don't know how they got it, but they evidently got yours too. AARP. They know about that birthday creeping up, and they start inundating you with mail, and that happened to you too.
Oh, it absolutely happened to me. I'm actually convinced now that the AARP is part of the NSA, and if they're not, they should be, because, man, those people, they track you down, and they find you, and they start sending you these. I thought the AARP email, first of all, I thought it was a catalog for white-collar prison uniforms. When I got the email, I opened it up, and there are these AARP elders marching towards you in their pleated, neutering khaki pants and their matching pastel sweaters. It was very depressing. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, and they wouldn't leave me alone. And, you know, that's just one of the signs that you start to notice that turning 50 is even, you know, there's a canard. To me, it is a canard. The 50 is the new 40, because, first of all, when you're 50, no one who's 40 thinks you're the same age as them unless you are very tattooed. It's a generational difference. It is really different. And you do start noticing that the world really treats you differently, no matter how great you might feel on any given day, or you know, because there are moments of, you know, a terrific wisdom that you can have at this age. Of course, no one wants to hear about it because you're older. But you know, I'd be standing in the supermarket, and I would look at a magazine, and it would say, "Looking good at 20, 30, 40." And beyond.
Yeah.
Oh my God! They can't even say the word 50. They're sending us to the great beyond. And of course, you know, I'm a comedian, so I'm making a joke about this. But when you're this age, you really do start to notice that you can feel marginalized.
Yeah, you point out that even the television ratings only care about people 18 to 49. After that, you might as well be dead. They don't care about you. They don't care.
It's true. Well, now, I mean, I've worked in Hollywood, so, and, you know, in Hollywood, 50 is 80 in actress years. So I suddenly realized, I mean, I this is not a book, let me just say, it's not a book about Hollywood. It's a book about what it means to be this age as my primary identity, which is as a wife, as a mother, as just a person, you know, as a woman, you know, living in America right now. But you do notice them. I was going to audition for a role as a mother in a commercial, and I ended up getting that commercial, but not playing a mother. The role I got was playing a crone in the Middle Ages.
Oh, my God.
Running through the streets, being chased by a giant troll. Well, this is interesting. Is there more of this to come? Maybe I won't get that root canal after all.
You know, I was gonna ask you how much of this is in you, do you, of this turning 50 and kind of having a I'm 50 stamped on your forehead, so everybody suddenly realizes, oh my God, she's old or he's old. How much of that is in our minds, because it's a milestone in a youth culture obsessed country? It's a milestone. And how much of it actually is reality? But I guess in Hollywood, it's reality.
In Hollywood, it's reality. But this, as I was saying, you know, what I did was for this book, it's not, you know, it's really not the, you know, Annabelle Gurwitch story of turning 50. It's really a story, and I wrote it specifically as a series of essays because I wanted to, each essay, you know, starts with an anecdotal story, which can be anything from taking my teenage son to a concert and realizing how invisible I was. That concert experience was like, I write that it's like a proof of Einstein's theory of parallel universes, because I suddenly realized that I was in an environment with these teenagers where the band was playing couldn't see me. The other teenagers who were there couldn't see me. My own son tries not to see me, being a teenager. Then the other essays deal with things, you know, that are very real. Like, and what that is particularly people who are close to my age, who we're considered tail end baby boomers, and we're being labeled what's called the sandwich generation.
Right.
This is not, you know, something I actually didn't come up with that term. Sociologists have termed this people who had children maybe in their late 30s, like I did. So we've got kids who are still at home who need our attention and our financial resources. We've got aging parents who also need the same thing. And plus, we're trying to stay viable and visible in the world, in the economy. The chances are, at least for me, I will be working into my afterlife, which I don't even believe in. But you know, there's very little chance of retirement with so many of us, you know, being, you know, financially challenged. So we're in what's being called the sandwich, and we're being stretched in all directions. You're like the meat; we're being squeezed by the bread. All these other things that need our attention and our resources, and there's nothing, you know, made up about that, or just about like, oh, how do I feel about turning this age? That's a very real thing. And I also do think it is a little bit of an indignity that sociologists have termed this the sandwich generation, because at this age, I can't eat bread. I can't eat carbohydrates. If I eat a cashew, I have to change into sweatpants. So that is where the, you know, I try to find a sense of humor in it all, but really it's a very real situation.
I got to tell you, unless you're using a headshot from, oh, I don't know, 1985, you don't.
I might be.
You don't look 50. And actors and actresses, and you already mentioned that 50 is like 80 in Hollywood years. Actors and actresses regularly shave years off their actual age, and they make certain plastic surgical adjustments. Most would hide the 50 mark. You didn't. In fact, by writing a book, you're just throwing it out there, announcing it to the world. Was that wise?
Probably not. Very ill-advised. As a matter of fact, the agent who had representing me, I called her to tell her I was writing this book, And coincidentally, she was calling to tell me it was actually this funny confluence of information that came out in that call. Her then client Jennifer Grey had just won Dancing with the Stars, and she said, "I can't believe what she did on the show. She announced she was 50. You would have thought she had just announced she was a serial killer." And she was saying, "She'll never work again." And interestingly, she fired me not long after I told her that I was writing a book about turning 50. But that's really, you know, the Hollywood thing is the tip of the iceberg. You know, the funny thing is what I did, you know, IMDb and everything on the internet, information is so pervasive now. You actually can't lie about your age.
So they know everything about you. Annabelle Gurwitch, which is our guest, her latest book is called "I See You Made an Effort: Compliments and Dignities and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50." This morning here on Charlotte Talks, I had to jump in there just for a second, but you make an interesting point.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, so I decided to embrace this age, and I did it for a number of reasons. I really did begin to feel that we as women and as people at this age were doing ourselves a disservice by constantly not being the age we said we were being, because any wisdom that comes from experience, you're really you're not having a chance to stand up for that, to actually be tapped for that when you're constantly telling people you're 10 years younger than you actually are. So one of the things that I did was I started writing on my business card, Annabelle Gurwitch, since 1961. I started thinking, you know, restaurants and companies, they're always proud of how long they've been in business, they've been around. Why don't we as people have that same value? You know, why our culture, as you said, is youth-focused? What about those really great values of endurance, of wisdom gained through experience? Unfortunately, on that business card, I wrote down an email address that I can't remember the password to. So if you got one of those cards, I'll never hear from you.
Because you can't get into your own, email. That's very funny. do you think that we make too much of this? I mean, even Hollywood. I think you point out that unless you're Meryl Streep, who's over 50, you don't work. You don't get a lot of parts. It's hard to find a part, a significant part, an important part. Why is it that way? Because there are a lot of people out there who are well over 50. I mean, look at this Marigold Hotel movie with all these folks from England who are in their 70s.
Well, look, the media is just the you could just use it as a, I don't want to say it's a canary in the coal mine, but, you know, it is just an example of how you can become marginalized. And look, it's not a surprise that Hollywood doesn't tell these stories as much, because the people who are primarily, you know, making these stories are people who are younger than you. But that happens, right? You know, that this is something that's happening in every industry. A lot of things that are marketed towards youth. If you just open any magazine or you look at, advertisements, they are geared towards young people. It's really sort of funny. I was watching television last night.
20 seconds.
And what's that?
20 seconds.
20 seconds. And I noticed that car commercials all talk about these young people, driving these cars. And, you know, what about me? I need to drive a car. You see how it that just plays out.
We're coming back with more with Annabelle Gurwitch in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to somebody who has the unique talent for turning less than ideal things into success. For instance, she was fired. We'll talk about this by Woody Allen. She turned it into a theater piece, a documentary, and I think a play on its third national tour called "You Say Tomato, I Say Shut Up." Her latest book is called "I See You Made an Effort: Compliments and Dignities and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50," about turning 50, because although 40 may be the new 30, you emphatically say 50 is not the new 40. Why not?
Well, you know, there are so many ways in which your life is different. You know, this book is a series of comedic essays, But I do write about serious issues, and, you know, one of those issues is just the way that your body changes. And, you know, I write about how it, you know, at the age of 50, I know the good cancers from the bad cancers. I have, like so many millions of Americans, also had boomeritis, which is considered an actual medical term now, which means you're exercising like you think you're younger than you are, and you have a sports-related accident. And I have ended up in the orthopedic boot, which I consider the must-have fashion accessory.
I have one.
Oh yes, well there you go.
Oh yes, it's quite nice. Yeah.
It's over 40. If you don't have one of these, if you've never been in the boot, nobody knows you actually still exercise. So I think it's a sort of a point of pride to have actually spent time in one now.
Yes, you're taking care of yourself, but now you can't, because you can't do that. You'll just re-injure yourself.
Exactly.
Your first chapter is called "Stay Funny," and that phrase came from something your gynecologist told you. What precipitated that advice? Why did he say that to you?
Well, this just, you know, getting older tests the limits of medical science, as I found out. So I was having those, you know, perimenopausal symptoms, brain fog, sort of hysterical rage, the typical things that actually, the funny thing is, you know, I'm at the age where I was going through menopause while my son was going through puberty, which were two kind of indistinguishable moments. We were kind of like, everyone in the house is raging. He had too many hormones. I didn't have enough. It was just the clash. It was like action movie. But so I go to see my gynecologist, you know, what can I do? And this is where things get very real for you at this age. He had suggested, you know, did I want to try hormone replacement therapy? The week that we were talking about this, that I went to see my doctor, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, front page articles, one paper says the reasons why it's safe, the other paper says don't do it, it's not safe. There is so much confusion around even what's appropriate for medically. So I go to my doctor and I say, you know, what should I do? And he says, stay. And there's a pause, and I think for a minute, what is he going to say? Is he going to say, stay happy, stay healthy, stay hydrated? No, he says, stay funny. And I think, this is the best, my doctor, this is the best advice that I can get from Western science. This is something, and yeah, that was actually
it's a coping mechanism.
Yeah. Well, listen, humor is a great coping mechanism, and as I always say, it's one benefit of age that my health insurance can't cancel. That you know, there's no policy that they cancel that. But you know, it just showed me sort of the limitation of what is really available for you. And I think, you know, psychologically, you know, humor is one of those things that it really does lift your spirits. And that is the thing, is I think you have to have a sense of humor. And what I always write about, I write about social trends and coping with them through humor. You know, while I was starting to write this book, I did some research, and I saw every 7 seconds an American turns 50. We are an aging society. So we really do have to figure out how to deal with this. And, you know, look, my little comedy book is in one, my little way of throwing down the gauntlet and saying, sure, I'm going to be striding into my future on my good ankle, hopefully. And I'm inviting other people to embrace this age instead of, you know, and try to just it's my one little way of staking a claim in the youth obsessed culture to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're visible and viable.
You have this way of looking at things, and sometimes unfortunate things, with a little quirky sense of humor twist. You don't tell jokes, but you see the fun in even some of the most tragic situations. When did you know that you were funny, and where do you think that sense of humor comes from?
You know, as I like to tell people, if there's anything about my failure to become a member of the top 1% of our country, it's that, you know, I can reflect what it's like to be someone in an economically challenged situation who faces, you know, a lot of real life problems. I think my sense of humor comes from being a reality-based person who's lived through a lot of challenging situations. You know, I did not grow up wealthy. We had money. We didn't have money. We moved around a lot. You know, those kinds of experiences. I've been employed. I've also been unemployed. My first job in New York was handing out flyers on the street, dressed as a clown for Arby's, and that can shape, you know, nobody wants those flyers.
Yeah, but you wanted to be in show business, and there you were.
That was a real entry into show business. But see, what that job taught me was that there was a benefit to being a clown. The clown makeup and costume prevented the people I was doing it in my own neighborhood from recognizing me.
Yes.
So that was a little bit less humiliating when they would turn my flyers down. But, you know, I've had a lot of experiences in life that I think have, you know, shaped my worldview that I've learned to deal with humor. I mean, you know, one thing my last book was about. I've been married now for 18 years, and one of the things I realized is that's the book You Say Tomato, I Say Shut Up, and we actually launched that book as a play in Charlotte. And
I thought that was the case. I just couldn't put my finger on it. Really?
Yes,
when did you do that?
At the Blumenthal.
Yes.
So Charlotte.
When was that?
That was, God, that's been like 4 or 5 years ago now, and it's been on tour since then. And one of the messages of that book was, you know, I started to think about how we as a society, we always celebrate the beginnings and we mourn the endings of things. So there's the wedding sections of newspapers. The Huffington Post now has a divorce section. But what about celebrating or exploring the middle of things, the middle of marriage? There's no, you never find any media that just says, yep, you know, they've been married for 15, still doing it. Yep, Jeff and Annabelle, they're still right in that middle. And I thought, you know, this the middle of marriage, that deserves some, you know, we need to shed some light on that. And we need to celebrate that as ridiculously challenging as it can be. So I'm always writing about these challenging situations. And I it'd be hard for me to say exactly when I realized, you know, I was funny. And it's something I don't really think of myself as being funny. That just sort of happened. And maybe you could say it happened when I was fired from this job that I had so many expectations for. That's when I was fired by Woody Allen. I ended up, you know, writing this book and doing this documentary about it. And I started to think about, if I could say what my sense of humor is, it's the dissonance between expectations and reality. And I think that is where humor comes in, because those two things are very far apart.
Yeah. This book is a series of essays. It's and a lot of it is your life. How much of this is embellished reality versus fiction?
Well, you know, all you have to do is walk into a department store and be accosted by salespeople who are wearing lab coats like they're doctors, and who are part of the multi-billion-dollar cosmeceutical industry. Mm-hmm. And when you ask that question, how much is embellished or fictionalized? Very little of it. And the experiences I have had, you know, mirror the cosmeceutical industry in that, you know. You know, particularly as a woman, you are targeted by this industry that is just full of these adjectives and adverbs that tell you these anti-aging elixirs that are so expensive that you can't make this stuff up. I have one chapter where I write about this, and I am not making up the fact that there is a product on the market it's really morally bankrupting. It's called Hope in a Jar. Hope in a Jar. I mean, that is so, that this is just, they're trying to take your money from you by telling you that there's something that's going to give you hope in a jar. I mean, you could really look at that on many levels, how frightening that is. But unless there is a miniature time machine inside their jar, which I don't believe there is, I mean, that should be illegal.
Well, it is hope for some people, isn't it? I mean, if they hope that it will work and they buy it, and there it is, hope in a jar.
Yes, unfortunately. I agree with that. It's all sort of a zero-sum game, all that stuff. It's a losing battle, ultimately, isn't it? It's a losing battle because, you know, if you're fortunate enough, you know, you get to age, and that's where, you know, it's all sort of kind of silly. And at the same time, we all not only want to, we want to feel good. We want to, you know, look our best. But what I'm really trying to, you know, ask this question of in the book is, but what does that mean? Is looking our best? Did I look my best when I was 20? Do I look my best when I'm 40? Do I look my best now? Why is that idea tethered to an age? And that's the very serious question that is at the heart of this, you know, comedic book, because if it's tethered to an age, then you're always going to be feeling not so great about yourself. Yeah. Because, you know, if you're lucky enough, you keep getting older.
I've asked this question of other people who have written books, and in those books there are some racy things, because you have a son and you have a husband, and you have put some racy things in this book, including, shall we just call it a delicate fantasy? Let's not really talk about the apple bar boy genius, but you wrote about that. So now that you have, what does it feel like to be so exposed? Put your fantasy of having some sort of a relationship with the boy genius out
well,
there.
Well, you know, what that really was, that's just really my version of a satire of 50 Shades of Grey. By the way, I am shade free. I've never read the book, but I feel like I have because it's in the ether. You've heard about it so much, and so I'm aware of what it is. But I thought when that came out, I thought, well, is this a book for someone my age? What's the sexual fantasy of a 50-year-old? And how does that actually play out? Because you know, first of all, I realized I'm having a Mrs. Robinson fantasy about my Apple genius, and I'm older than Anne Bancroft was when she played Mrs. Robinson. And, you know, that chapter is based on, you know, the real story of just realizing how ridiculous it would be. What would I say to this person? How would I go about doing this? But, you know, I do think about, I mean, I'm a wife, I'm a mother. I think about what I write and in terms of what my husband and, you know, what everyone will read. My son is a teenager. He has absolutely no interest in reading what I write because I wrote it. I do think about what I write in terms of as a memoirist. I try to, I think about what's he going to think about this in 20 years when he maybe picks it up. But I, you know, so there's always, I think every writer, you, even people who you're thinking write very revealing stuff. I mean, there were chapters that did not make it into this book.
Ah, Annabelle Gurwitch, your book is called I See You Made an Effort, Compliments and Dignities and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50. She'll be in town next week. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. And we're on Charlotte Talks this morning on WFAE. You also go into a bit of self-confession here in that story about the apple bar or the apple genius bar, in that you begin thinking, you know, in your youth, it would have been a snake-hipped rock musician that maybe would have then ignited a fantasy. But now it's just some guy who can fix your technology.
Yes. Well, this is, you know, one of the things that I think you realize as you, it's one of those markers of age is, you know, I think about what do I find to be a sexual turn-on? That's someone who can fix my computer. And that is a way that the brain has definitely changed. But, you know, I do, one of the things I write about with my teenager is, you know, this is one of, again, one of those markers of age. You can find yourself having a conversation with a younger person, whether it's your child or someone else, and they'll say something like, what kind of computer did you bring to college with you? You just have to laugh. You know, this is just a real moment. Yeah. And, you know, I do try to sort of hit a lot of the touchstones of being this age. So I write about everything from these moments of with my son to things like helping my parents sell my childhood home and what, you know, that whole experience of helping them move to the next chapter of their life. And again, you know, I try to find humor in that because it's a very profound moment.
And here's something else that you write about that I've thought about too, and I think a lot of people have probably thought about this. With age comes wisdom, and there's a lot of wisdom at 50 that you could impart to younger people, and they could benefit from it. You could help them not make some of the same mistakes that you did, and maybe calm them down and let them see that not everything is a life or death situation, that this too shall pass. But you say that the things you write about in this book, they can't hear.
Only people
over 40 can hear them. We have a minute. Talk about that.
Well, I say, you know, that all that aging wisdom is, it's like a high-pitched dog whistle that only people over 40 can hear. So when people ask me advice who are younger, I basically stick with things like, for women, wear a sports bra. I think that goes without saying. It's understandable. And the other is, floss your teeth more. You can't understand when you're younger how painful root canal surgery will be. You know, I just try to stick with the practical.
Yeah, and they can't hear it because they are immortal.
There's some things you can only learn through experience. And that's why I think, you know, if you are anywhere, you know, between the ages of 40 and death, you'll laugh at this book, that laughter of recognition. But don't laugh so hard that, like, you pull a rib or something.
I want to come back and talk about being fired because I'm in broadcasting, and there are only two kinds of people in broadcasting, those who have been fired or those who are waiting to be fired. We'll talk about your and other people's experiences in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Annabelle Gurwitch, author, playwright, actress. Her latest book is called I See You Made an Effort, Compliments, Indignities, and Survival Stories from the Edge of 50. She will be in town under the auspices of the Jewish Federation Spring Lecture next Thursday at Temple Beth El at 6:30. We have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. You've had a really varied career. You've been a commentator, an author, as I said, a playwright. Your acting credits include Seinfeld, Boston Legal, Dexter. You were one of those wonderful secretaries on Murphy Brown, who lasted, I think, what, an episode or two because she fired all of her secretaries.
Right.
And you were there then at a very hot period for that show. And you've hosted TV shows. And how did all this start for you? Where did you come from? How did this happen?
You know, I have had a varied career, and I'm interested in a lot of things, but basically what I've always been interested in is storytelling. I happen to be, you know, not everybody knows this, but from Alabama. I'm from Mobile, Alabama, and I do think, not to be, you know, just only people from the South are great storytellers, but there's been a long tradition in my family of storytelling, and there's something about either acting in stories or telling my stories that I do relate to being a Southerner, and that's always been an interest of mine. And I went to, after growing up, I went to NYU, and I started working in theater, and that's my real background. I started the New York Shakespeare Festival. I was a, you know, trained actress. And then somehow or another, after doing many, many very serious plays, I ended up working in television primarily for most of my acting career. And I'm just not quite sure how that happened, except there's a lot of TV on TV. And so I ended up in that.
And most of it's not experimental German theater. Most of it is sitcoms.
Most of it is not. I was doing very, very, you know, a lot of experimental and avant-garde theater. But what that did give me was a background in art that had a real content. And that's just sort of funny because it's sort of where I've come back in some sense, kind of full circle. You know, one of my favorite jobs I've ever done was is doing commentary on NPR, and I do that out in Los Angeles on a couple of shows out here today, and I, because I'm interested in the world, and the way I see the world is, it turns out, in a comedic way, but I'm interested in how, you know, stories shape how we see the world, and that's what I've been able to do now in my writing, and it's just completely unexpected, but I think it really did start with the experience that I had working with Woody Allen in a play off Broadway in New York. This is, you know, came at a point where I had left Dinner and a Movie, job I'd had for 7 years, and I was returning to theater, and doing this play was very exciting for me because I always loved Woody Allen's comedy, and that's, again, one of those examples of, like, the difference between the expectations and the reality, because he just didn't like me. He didn't think I was funny or anything I was doing is funny.
Did he cast you?
He did cast me. But, you know, this is very emblematic of the way he works. He's known to fire people all the time. If you're not doing what is he wants in a particular role, he would just as soon recast someone else. Now, this kind of thing happens all the time in show business, and it happens all the time with him.
But when he fired you, how did he fire you? Was he nice about it? Was he just a jerk about it? What did he say to you?
He said, "What you're doing is terrible. Don't ever do that again, not even in another play." Now, I would say not particularly nice. But as anybody knows who's been fired, whether someone tells you we're going in a different direction,
yes,
the company is downsizing, you feel
it's
in the
just
same
not
way,
working. It's just not working out.
It's just not working out. But what happened at that moment, and it really was one of those, you know, sometimes in life you do have this sort of like epiphany. While this was happening, and I was just, you know, miserable, let me just say, I was just miserable, I did have this idea that my story might be able to be useful to other people, that it could be, because he was such a well-known person, that I could use my story to get other people to tell their stories. Because what I realized was I would ask other people, I was telling everyone, hey, I was just fired, I just couldn't stop talking about it. People would tell me their stories, and I realized how much better it was making me feel. And I thought, you know, on a wider level, people could use this. So it became this sort of mission for me to collect stories. It became sort of a Studs Terkel project. I went all over the country, and I talked to people from every industry, everyone from people who worked on assembly lines in East Lansing, Michigan, to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. I started collecting stories through my job on NPR from all over the country, from every sector of employment, and it began to be a look about this, you know, what, you know, first of all, this, every story was more hilarious than the other story. Once time has passed, things can be funny, by the way, not in the moment.
Yes.
But and I realized that there was this value in this kind of storytelling, and so I wrote a book. I we did a traveling show around the country, and I would invite audience members to get up after people had told their stories on stage. It was, you know, and then I made a film about it, and it really started for me to become a way of seeing my comedic voice, my writer voice, and the way that I was looking at stories and how to tell stories. And so that was a kind of a watershed moment. And, you know, one of the things I write about in my book, I See You Made an Effort, is how many of us at this age have to be reinventors in our careers. And I am a classic reinventor. I kind of aged out of my career as an actress, you know, working less, and I have a new career. So not that I advise anyone to do what I've done, but just the trajectory of being, you know, a reinventor, that's a story that is, you know, I'm just one of many people our age who've changed careers.
And that comes many times as a result of being fired for whatever mm-hmm. reason. I was wondering, when you went around the country and you collected these stories, is there a common thread that seems to run through them? And do most people find that there is life after being fired?
Well, you know, those are really big questions, and the answer is yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. There's the experience of being fired that is transformative for people, that is hilarious in retrospect, because you realize you're in the wrong profession, or you realize things about yourself that are making you unemployable. One of my favorite stories is Jeff Garlin, the comedian's story about being fired 17 times in one summer from his job. So he was hired by every store in the mall near where he grew up, and fired for wearing a hanger on his head, or just these very silly, funny things. But you know, the endurance that you learn from these experiences. He was fired once in the middle of a stand-up act.
Oh my God!
They said, "We've had enough. We're sending you home now." You know, there's hilarity, there's endurance, there's lessons to be learned. But of course, you know, there's also the serious side of the changing paradigm of work in America, which has left some people, in a very difficult situation, where you know we live in a culture now, in an economic culture of, there's a statistic about how the average person will, you know, used to think about having a gold watch and retiring at 50 or 60, and this just doesn't exist anymore. And for people who are not able to change that quickly, who function better in a long-term job situation, or whose careers have just disappeared in our changing economy, this is very difficult. So, you know, it's a mixed bag, in the same way that, you know, there are these fantastic and hilarious things about aging that if you can deal with it, this does bring wisdom and all kinds of knowledge along with the orthopedic boot, but it also has challenges, and real challenges. I mean, you know, this is where the mixture of comedy and tragedy come together. I have something very sexy now, which is osteoarthritis. There's not a lot funny about that, except that I have just determined that I am just, you know, when I tell the story of how I ended up being the youngest patient for my rheumatologist, which is hilarious. When your doctor tells you you're their youngest patient, oh, it's so funny. But, you know, as with everything, it tests your coping abilities with everything you get to survive. So, you know, that's, again, also where I find humor between that fine line between comedy and tragedy. Mm. Humor has been my coping mechanism.
Yeah, you're able to find humor in some of the darkest places, because you spend a lot of time talking about, for lack of a better term, I guess, middling out, reaching the middle stage of a chosen career and not the high echelons. By 50, you either know you're at the top of your game or, to quote Peggy Lee, that's all there is. It's not going to get any better than this, so you have to make the best of it. And you talk about making just enough money, in your case, to live Hollywood adjacent, to subsist on a middle income. Is it more difficult, do you think, for people in Hollywood who have worked with big people? I mean, people like, I don't know who you've worked with, but...
Well, lots of people. Everybody from Jim Carrey,
right,
to Anne Hathaway. I mean, there's really very few people who... Vincent Carthars or Shia LaBeouf, I played his mother. Absolutely. Whether it's easier or harder, one thing I do think it is an interesting situation where in my business, you do find yourself maybe saying three lines to Sarah Jessica Parker in a movie. So it's this, you do find yourself in, you kind of can't believe it. You can't believe some people, and maybe people that you started your career with. My good friend Bill Maher, who I've been so fortunate enough to do his show many times, has been a big supporter of my writing. You know, it's crazy, when we first met, I was the one with the TV shows, and he was, you know, a comedian going from gig to gig, and now he is, you know, just tremendously successful, influential, and my house can fit into his guest house. And so, you know, you do have this contact, and it is a dramatic sort of situation where you are constantly in contact with people of, you know, I would say constantly, you know, you do have contact with people who are in the very top of the top 1%. And, you know, that's an interesting, I wouldn't say is it good, is it bad, it's an interesting vantage point because, you know, you do see, I mean, particularly in American culture, how different life is and how much, you know, your economic station influences your experience in American life. And I do take time to write about status in the book because I think that's something that you do think about at this age, or at least I do, where I realize, wow, the door has closed on certain experiences. It has opened other experiences. And this is, you know, the title of the book is, the subtitle is Compliments, Indignities, and Survival Stories. And, you know, ultimately, I do think that coming to terms with certain realities is not a bad thing. I mean, sure, it means that I am currently shopping for roommates who I can go to an elder hostel in Uzbekistan with come the day that I ever can afford to retire. I'm taking emails and numbers, who could be my roomie. I always try to find the humor in this. But I do think that it is an opportunity. Age, one of those gifts of aging, I say that with a little bit of sarcasm, is that you have a chance to really think about what's valuable and important to you.
Annabelle Gurwitch is our guest on Charlotte Talks this morning on WFAE. You say, you wrote an essay, which I think aired on a local, it could have been NPR, but a local public radio station in Hollywood, about the Hollywood Awards season. In that you wrote that there's this nagging decision. What will you be doing on awards night? You could go to a party to watch with friends, but you'll risk being told, it's amazing how you manage to stay creative, which is industry speak for it's a miracle your body hasn't been found decomposing in a flea bag motel in the high desert. Are things really that catty out there?
Yes. the answer would be yes. Of course, you know, when I talk about Hollywood adjacent, I mean it's when you live in an industry town, which it is somewhat in Los Angeles, you know, you are in the shadow of this amazing wealth and success. My daily life, however, is not that. My daily life is driving the carpool, is shopping for food, arranging orthodontist appointments. It's you know, I'm a freelancer. It's looking for work all the time, I have a tree that is diseased in my backyard. Maintaining our house, being a wife. I mean, there's house. My parents that we've just moved into a senior living facility. So, you know, my daily life is not could be happening in many other cities, and it is very filled with those kind of minutiae and details that are vexing to everybody. But there is this funny vantage that, you know, you write from where you just people assume when you're living in Hollywood, oh, it's award season, what are you doing? Well, on award season, I'll be washing down the kitchen floors in my sweatpants. So, you know, there is this funny thing, and then you turn on the TV and you see someone who you were there at their first job.
Yeah. Annabelle Gurwitch is coming to town later on, next week. We have information about that on our website. Her latest book is called I See You Made an Effort, which may be an FX TV series in the near future. Thank you for the hour.